Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the new government in Greece, led by Alexis Tsipras, the head of the left-wing Syriza party, whose first act was to form a governing coalition with the right-wing anti-immigrant party Independent Greeks. Economist James Galbraith, a professor of public policy at the University of Texas at Austin, joins us. He wrote an op-ed back in June at the New York Times with Greece's now new finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis. Only Syriza can save Greece. And we will discuss how Syriza, which is an acronym for Radical Coalition of the Left, can meet the expectations of its voters and get out from under the debt burden and the austerity imposed by Greece's creditors, which the new finance minister described as fiscal waterboarding policies that have turned Greece into a debt colony. Then we'll examine the substance behind the atmospherics of President Obama's visit to India, where he watched the colorful Republic Day parade of mostly Soviet and Russian military hardware with India's Prime Minister Modi, the first American head of state to do so in 65 previous parades. Ashley Tellis, a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, who served on the National Security Council staff as a special assistant to the president and senior director for strategic planning and Southwest Asia, joins us to discuss the revival of the nuclear power deal between the two countries and efforts to persuade India to deal with global warming. Then finally, we'll look into this last weekend's Iowa Freedom Summit of Tea Party Republican presidential candidates and get a report from Robert Leonard, who covered the 2008 and 2012 Iowa caucuses for KNIA KRLS Radio in Knoxville and Pella, Iowa. He has an article at Salon.com, "The World Has Gone to Hell, A Weekend at the Iowa Freedom Summit." And we will discuss the performances of the crowded bench of Republican presidential hopefuls who showed up in this important primary state and the notable absence of Jeb Bush, Mitt Romney, Marco Rubio, Bobby Jindal, and Rand Paul. And joining us now is James K. Galbraith, who is a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute and serves as chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security. His books include Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Future, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, and The Predator State. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galbraith.
Good to be with you.
And Alex Tsipras has been sworn in as the new Prime Minister of Greece. He showed up without a tie at the ceremony and eschewed the ritual greeting or prayer by the Orthodox priests. Didn't obviously want to be blessed by them. And in fact, his first act as Prime Minister was to lay flowers at a memorial of Greek resistance fighters killed by the Nazis during World War II. Any subtext to that, do you think?
Oh, I'm sure there was, yes. It was a clear statement of the Greek spirit, which was one of very powerful and dogged resistance to the Nazi occupation.
Which was incredibly brutal.
Excuse me?
Which was very brutal.
Oh, yes, indeed. Indeed, the Greeks paid a huge and heavy price for it. So this is something which I think struck a chord.
But is that chord then in connection to the biggest creditors, or at least the dominant force in the Eurozone?
Nothing tactless about it. Mm-hmm. This was a statement of. Undeniable sincerity. But no, it wasn't. I don't think it carries any implications. And in fact, quite the reverse. I think the Greek government is approaching its partner governments in the European Union as peers and partners on the presumption that there will be a pragmatic approach, a recognition that the policies that have been imposed by the Troika have been a catastrophic failure in Greece, that they've pushed Greek society to the brink of dissolution, caused an enormous amount of stress and hardship, and have been driving the Greek professional classes to emigration and taking the quality of the healthcare system and so forth down to intolerable levels. So these things have to be faced as facts, and the policies which have led to this result have to be treated for what they are, which is not at all economic growth policies, but rather policies that were imposed for ideological and political reasons and to satisfy the creditors who were interested in having and being able to acquire assets at fire sale prices. That is not a program for economic recovery, never was, didn't have the slightest chance of succeeding, did not succeed, and the Greek electorate rejected it in this rather astonishing demolition of all the previously powerful parties of government in Greece.
So what then explains the first act of joining a coalition government with the right-wing anti-immigrant party Independent Greeks?
Well, first of all, he fell just short by two seats of having an absolute majority in the parliament, so there needed to be a coalition with someone. I believe the Independent Greeks offered a vote of confidence essentially without condition, certainly without serious ones. So I don't think this makes any material difference to the policies of the Syriza government. What it does, however, and the Guardian had an interesting comment on this, is signal to the European partners that the Greek government is going to be a very tough negotiating partner, because there is the possibility that if you were to say, okay, you're now you're in government, you must do what all previous governments have done and capitulate, then the government would fall immediately, which it's not going to do. So I think it did send at least that clear signal out to the rest of the Eurozone. But otherwise, it was there was either, given who had gotten into parliament, there was either the coalition with the Independent Greeks or the coalition with the Third Force of the River, Topatami, would have been possibly a more difficult coalition. So he took the one that was available. He has a solid government, and they will go forward from there.
And again, I'm speaking with James K. Galbraith, who's a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a senior scholar of the Levy Economics Institute and serves as chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security. His books include Balancing Acts, Technology Finance, and The American Future, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, and The Predator State. Well, apparently Alexis Tsipras has already calmed investors' nerves, talking about he wants negotiation rather than confrontation. Quoting, "The new Greek government will be ready to cooperate and negotiate for the first time with our peers a just, mutually beneficial, and viable solution." So, tell us about.
If investors were calmed by that, then they couldn't have been very nervous in the first place.
Well, he's already.
The policy of Syriza as a campaign, as a party, has always been to negotiate a change in European policy. So he didn't say anything different today than he's been saying for the entire period of the opposition.
And he's been making it clear that he doesn't want to pull out of the euro, which has been a subject of speculation, which seems rather overblown.
Syriza has never been a Grexit party. It has been a Europeanist party that wishes to stay in the eurozone. The decision, therefore, about what will happen on that doesn't rest with Syriza. It's really a question of whether the European partners are prepared to accept that the policy that has been imposed on Greece is not a policy of economic recovery, but a policy which we can say politely that if it was a policy of economic recovery, that it simply didn't work, it was misguided, and therefore needs to be changed. That's the fundamental issue. And the second question is, while that discussion is underway, will the European partners continue to provide the financial and support and monetary stabilization that Greece and all the other crisis countries need in order to get through this period? There are certain there are debt payments that are coming due that cannot be met. The position of the Greek government is that you don't lend to the new Greek government will be that you don't lend to a bankrupt. You negotiate down that debt. That is a discussion that will have to go on. And then there's the question of whether the European Central Bank will use its very considerable powers to continue to stabilize the financial system and particularly the Greek banking system while negotiations are underway. If those things happen, then it comes down to a negotiation over what are the appropriate and acceptable terms of economic policy. And I would lay pretty good money on the persuasiveness of the Greek economists, who are as good as any in Europe, in fact better than any others I've encountered in Europe, in analyzing and articulating what needs to be done.
So tell us about Yanis Varoufakis, who is...
Varoufakis,
a Greek-Australian who has been described as a combination of John Maynard Keynes and a hint of Karl Marx. He's a self-proclaimed accidental economist, and you wrote an op-ed with him back in June at the New York Times, Only Syriza Can Save Greece. So tell us about the new finance minister.
Well, Yanis has been for the last couple of years my colleague here at the University of Texas. He's been teaching at the LBJ School of Public Affairs. He is was a sensational hit with our students, for sure, and an extraordinarily good colleague. I got to know him quite well. He's a protean figure. If you go back over the entire history of the European crisis, I don't think there's anybody who's written more about it and been more consistently on the mark about what was happening, particularly in the epicenter of the crisis that was Greece. And he is the author, along with Stuart Holland, and I made a modest contribution to it, of a program called The Modest Proposal to Resolve the Eurozone Crisis, which has the very nice feature of being entirely disciplined to stay within the existing European charters. So it's a set of proposals which, because of the deep knowledge of my co-authors of how the European system is actually set up, could be implemented under current laws and treaties. And that would fundamentally and very importantly change the direction of the European economy and the current tendency to for it to basically stress until it breaks apart. And that's, so he has a very strong background, not only in the level of what's going on in his native country, Greece, but also at the level of the Eurozone, Europe as a whole. And beyond that, I mean, he's, as you say, he has in fact taught in Australia. He has taught in the United States. He has taught for a while in England as well. So he's a figure with a very wide reputation in professional economics, very creative, an important theorist in certain fields as well.
So what do you think, though, can be done, just in closing, James Galbraith, to basically make Greece productive again? Because obviously there's a problem with people not paying their taxes. There's enormous debt burden. There's tourism. You've got this wealthy class of oligarchs that Varoufakis has railed against in the past. And if you irritate them too much, they'll just move their luxury yachts somewhere else.
Up to a point, that's true. Although I think it is important that Greece find a stable bargain between some of its citizens who are extremely wealthy and the rest of the population. There needs to be a new understanding in Europe of what it takes to have a stable European Union. Not every country is going to become a center for the production of BMWs and Mercedes-Benzes. And there's a tendency in any large continental economy for the very excellent industrial strengths to concentrate in fairly narrow areas. And it's true in the United States. It's true and very much true in Europe. So there needs to be, in some sense, a new bargain that covers the whole of the European surface that provides for methods to stabilize the economies that are, let's say, structurally less productive, of which Greece is certainly an example. So that is going to be part of the problem down the road. But the immediate question is getting a good faith negotiation to change what is plainly a failed policy and to stabilize the situation of a country which is in deep distress. And the European Union is predicated on the idea that every member state of the European Union will be preserved and will survive and will have their living standards gradually converge toward the high levels that are characteristic of the most successful countries. So they have to work out a modality to make that happen, and that becomes, in some sense, the long-range objective. Again, the short-range one is just to get through the changes in policy that will immediately stabilize the situation.
Well, James Galbraith.
And on structural reforms.
Well, James Galbraith, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with James Galbraith, who's a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a senior scholar of the Levy Economics Institute and serves as chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security. His books include Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Future, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, and The Predator State. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the substance behind the atmospherics of President Obama's visit to India.
Μα θα έρθει κάποτε η ώρα και δεν θα ξέρεις που χρωστάς. Για τα λεφτά τα κάνεις όλα, για τα λεφτά δεν μ' αγαπάς.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ashley Tellis, a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, specializing in international security, defense, and Asian strategic issues. He was a senior advisor to the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs at the State Department, where he was intimately involved in negotiating the civil nuclear agreement with India. Previously, he served as senior advisor to the ambassador at the U.S. Embassy in New Delhi and on the National Security Council staff as special assistant to the president and senior director for strategic planning and Southwest Asia. He's the author of India's Emerging Nuclear Posture and co-author of Interpreting China's Grand Strategy, Past, Present and Future. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ashley Tellis.
Thank you, Ian. Happy to be here.
And the President of the United States attended the annual Republic Day parade, which is the first time in 65 years that an American head of state has been the guest of the Prime Minister, in this case, Prime Minister Modi. And that in itself is pretty significant, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I think for at least a couple of reasons. This is the first time an American president has actually gone back to India twice in his official tenure. And of course, this is the first time that an American president has graced India's Republic Day as the chief guest. Republic Day is very important in India because it is the commemoration of the day that India became a constitutional democracy in 1950. And so it is one of India's three big secular holidays. And for the president to be in attendance at this event is a very big thing.
And of course, the parade is put on by India's military, and much of what the president witnessed, although the troops and were very colorful, was Soviet and Russian military hardware. Do you think that's going to...
It's not quite that. I mean, the parade is actually an interesting combination of both a Russian May Day-style parade and a Macy's Thanksgiving parade. That is, you get both, you know, the display of hardware and the hard power of the Indian state, but you also get an endless procession of tableaux and floats, which are put up by the Indian states, as well as, you know, various non-governmental associations. So it's really a curious mixture of both the hard power and the soft power that defines India today.
Well, I was going to ask you, though, Ashley, given that there's been this longstanding relationship with India and the Soviet Union and then Russia and the U.S. conversely with Pakistan, It seems to me that, there's a sort of shift going under here, a sort of tectonic shift underway. And my sense is that the United States and the Obama administration are pretty fed up with Pakistan. And clearly there's a strong personal relationship between these two leaders. So in bringing up the Russian hardware, my question would be, do you think that the U.S. and India are going to sort of cement a stronger relationship, and in the subsequent Republic Day parades, we might see a few more, a little bit of American military equipment?
Well, I believe they actually did display a couple of items of American equipment that India purchased recently. I believe the C-130 transport planes were in display. I think the C-17 strategic transports were also involved in the flypast. And I think they may have also had the newest anti-submarine aircraft that India has purchased for the from the United States, which is the P-8 Poseidon. But your basic point is really, I think, the point that, you know, our listeners should pay attention to, which is that there is a steady transformation in both India's view of the United States and in the American view of India. India no longer sees Russia as being a unique or privileged provider of high technology equipment, including defense equipment. And the United States no longer sees India as being a country on the other side of the fence, as it was during the Cold War. In fact, the U.S., since President Clinton, has made extraordinary efforts to build this new relationship with New Delhi because of the larger geopolitical interests in Asia, and because the growing Indian economy really offers India new offers the United States new opportunities that we've not had before.
So you were involved, Ashley Tellis, with negotiating the civil nuclear agreement with India that, since the Clinton administration, appeared to be somewhat stalled, but now it's being revived. At least that's what we're learning from this current presidential trip of Obama's to India. Has global warming been an issue in jump-starting that dormant agreement?
I think there were two calculations that drove India to revisit the agreement. The first was that there is terrific pressure on India to make good new commitments on climate change. And nuclear energy is one of those environmental-friendly sources of energy, and India is re-looking at nuclear energy as part of its larger energy mix. So that's clearly one element that has pushed India to revisit the resuscitation of the agreement. The second element was that I think they recognized that after all the efforts that the United States had made, both with respect to amending its own law and reaching out to the international community to integrate India into the global nuclear regime, it was somewhat unfair to leave this agreement incomplete and hanging. And if the strategic partnership had to really deepen, India would have to look anew at what needed to be done to fix the problems with respect to the civil nuclear agreement. And that's what this prime minister has done. It's his way of signaling to the United States that something that is so important to Washington is something he takes seriously. And he was determined to get rid of this albatross, which he inherited. I mean, he had no role to play in the makings of the peculiar liability law that caused all these problems. But he is letting us know by, you know, the effort he's making to craft a new agreement that this is a way of putting the relationship back on track.
So what is behind the American pressure on this deal, this nuclear deal, which you're involved in? In as much as nuclear power has been pretty much stalled in this country, and after Fukushima, there's been enormous amounts of questions about its safety and viability. So where is the pressure coming from this side in terms of this agreement?
I think at the U.S. end, the concerns and the calculations today are primarily commercial. As you point out, nuclear power has suffered real reverses in the United States and internationally, especially after Fukushima. But it's well and alive in India and in the developing world, you know, most exceptionally China. India is seriously thinking of a very substantial enlargement of its nuclear generation capacity. And the United States wants to get into the action. it wants to make certain that when India begins to actually purchase reactors, primarily from foreign vendors, that American companies are not excluded from the competition. And so the U.S. for the last several years now has been in intense conversations with India, trying to get it to fix its liability law so that American vendors will be able to enter the Indian market and really have a level playing field. And that's really what the agreement seems to be promising, assuming that the agreement actually delivers in a way that the U.S. wants. But if so, then this will be a big step ahead.
And again, I'm speaking with Ashley Taylor, who's a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he was a senior advisor to the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs at the State Department and previously served as a senior advisor to the ambassador at the U.S. Embassy in New Delhi and on the National Security Council staff as special assistant to the President and senior director for Strategic Planning and Southwest Asia. He's the author of India's Emerging Nuclear Posture and co-author of Interpreting China's Grand Strategy, Past, Present, and Future. Well, of course, solar power also was a part of the mix and a part of the discussions. And in terms of this problem that has always beset any idea of a global regime to cut greenhouse gases, has always been the haves versus the have-nots. And India is the world's 10th largest economy, the third largest polluter in terms of CO2, but arguably needs, or at least says it needs, time to wean itself from coal and other polluting sources. So is there a possibility, as the economic miracle happens in India, which it clearly is, and it's, I think by 2040 it's supposed to, the economy is supposed to reach or surpass China's, will there be more and more solar and alternative energies in the mix?
Oh, I think so. India is making a very big push on renewables in addition to nuclear power. In fact, when you look at the energy mix, say, going out to 2040, nuclear power is still a relatively small fraction of India's energy mix. Solar is going to be very large, and India is targeting about 100 gigawatts of new solar capacity by 2040. So solar is very clearly front and center in Prime Minister Modi's calculations. What he wants from the United States, though, is two things where solar energy is concerned. First, he wants American companies to be able to come to India and manufacture solar panels there. So contributing not simply to the energy question, but also to the resuscitation of India's manufacturing base. And the second thing that he wants from the United States is actually financial assistance with respect to pushing the envelope on renewables. And the U.S. obviously has advanced technologies in a variety of areas, and that's very much on Mr. Modi's priorities.
So what do you make of all of this twittering, I guess, is the best way to describe it, going on in social media and in the media in India about Prime Minister Narendra Modi's his wardrobe? I mean, it's pretty extraordinary that apparently he wore a pinstripe suit at the parade.
Yes, he did wear a pinstripe suit, and the stripes apparently had his name embroidered almost microscopically into the fabric. So he's certainly setting a new trend.
So that's a little egotistical, wouldn't you say?
That way, if true, that would certainly be the least of the things that one could complain about Mr. Modi, as long as, you know, he keeps delivering on the things that matter to Indians, right, which is a return to high economic growth, an effort made to clean up the country, to provide employment, and to deal with, you know, the old vexations of inflation. I think Indians will forgive him, you know, a little immodesty.
But he's a bit of a fashion hound, isn't he?
He is. And he has certainly, you know, he certainly brought a little color to what is otherwise a very drab political class. And for a country with all its challenges, you know, a little color can't hurt.
So what's the nature of the relationship between President Obama and Narendra Modi? Because you recall, Ashley Taylor, that when he was Modi was elected, there was a great deal of consternation because he was essentially banned from coming to the United States by the State Department, and that was quietly lifted. And then he showed up here, and they met a few times, but they seem to have bonded, and they seem to have a genuine friendship.
They do. And in fact, that is one of the surprising developments of the last several months. When he came to the United States for the first time in September, he was really quite unsure about what kind of a welcome he would get here because of the history of, you know, his previous interactions with official Washington. But the president really went out of his way to make him comfortable. And that dinner that he hosted for him in the White House, which was a strange dinner on at least one count because Modi was in the midst of a religious fast and therefore did not partake of the food, but was very touched by the president's efforts and the sentiments that were expressed during that dinner. And then the next day, the fact that the president took him out for a one-on-one walk to the Martin Luther King Memorial, where they really spent, you know, the better part of an hour together just talking about their political histories and things like that, I think made a great difference. And so when he went back to Delhi, he really started looking for ways to reciprocate. And the idea of inviting President Obama to come back as the chief guest for a public day was really his own idea. And it was his way of signaling both a thank you and a desire to take this relationship further.
So is it because they have sort of similar sort of humble backgrounds? What do you think is why these two seem to get on so well?
Well, I think it's a combination of a couple of things. Clearly, both see themselves as outsiders to the established political class. You know, they've pulled themselves up by their bootstraps and reached the positions they have the hard way. That's on the personal side. But I think you do not want to underestimate the imperatives of national interest. For the United States, India is important for the larger success of its rebalance to the Asia-Pacific. And I think President Obama would have quoted any Indian leader, whether it was Prime Minister Modi or someone else, precisely because of India's importance to American interests in Asia. And the same is true for India. India, you know, lives next door to this rising behemoth called China. And I don't think the Indians feel that they can cope with the rise of Chinese power independently without having a very strong and, you know, tight strategic bonds with Washington. And so I think in that sense, both countries are fated to come together and have close relations. And the fact that their leaders have hit it off, you know, doesn't hurt either.
So how will this strategic triangle work between the U.S., China, and India, given that Modi's also tried, and apparently with some success, to develop closer ties with China?
I think it is going to be a delicate triangulation. India will continue to look to China for the things that China can do for it. So, for example, China has huge foreign exchange resources. It can plow some of those investable funds into Indian infrastructure, into Indian manufacturing, and so on and so forth. So to the degree that China can be helpful, I think India wants to exploit China as a source of capital. But India, at the same time, is deeply suspicious of China's geopolitical ambitions. It's always conscious of the fact that there is a long-standing rivalry between the two countries, and that even as we speak, China is in occupation of many hundreds of thousands of square miles of Indian territory. And that automatically puts India in a position where it has to look for other forms of insurance. And the United States is one very important form of insurance. The U.S. has similar considerations. I mean, we have a very tight-knit set of economic ties with the Chinese, which we are not going to sacrifice for India or anyone else. But we are also conscious of the fact that China is likely to be our most important geopolitical competitor in Asia. And so reaching out to other countries on China's periphery, like Japan, India, Australia, Singapore, is very importantly part of our own national calculus. And so this is a relationship that is built fundamentally on a convergence of interests.
Well, just in closing, Ashley, tell us, do you think that the U.S. is ready to cut bait with Pakistan and essentially hand it over to China?
No, I don't think so. I think we have really important interests with Pakistan. They don't have the same intensity that they did during the Cold War. But as long as the threat of jihadi terrorism hangs out there, and I don't see it going away anytime soon, I think the U.S. partnership with Pakistan will persist, though it will be a very difficult and very treacherous negotiation at times. But the U.S.-Pakistan relationship will survive.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Ashley Tellis.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Ashley Tellis, who's a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he was a senior advisor to the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs at the State Department, where he was intimately involved in negotiating the civil nuclear agreement with India. And previously, he served as a senior advisor to the ambassador at the United States Embassy in New Delhi and on the National Security Council staff as special assistant to the president and senior director for strategic planning in Southwest Asia. He's the author of India's Emerging Nuclear Posture and co-author of Interpreting China's Grand Strategy, Past, Present and Future. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into last weekend's Iowa Freedom Summit of Tea Party Republican presidential candidates. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Leonard, special news editor for KNIA, KRLS, Knoxville, and Pella, Iowa, where he covered the 2008 and 2012 Iowa caucuses. He's an anthropologist and author of Yellow Cab and has an article at Salon.com, The World Has Gone to Hell, A Weekend at the Iowa Freedom Summit. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Leonard.
Well, thank you, Ian. I'm pleased to be here.
And you had the unique privilege of experiencing the most of the Republican field running or trying to run for president in 2016. And it's quite an extraordinary list. But I take it the host, Steve King, a local congressman, and David Bossi, the head of Citizens United, who orchestrated this meeting, you say they came out the winners?
Well, I think that they did. There's a lot of people that don't like to take Steve King seriously. He's got a lot of what some people consider to be extreme views. But his constituency loves him. He's a very interesting man with some interesting perspectives I don't necessarily agree with. But he captured that, you know, that part of the party that will help shape the Iowa caucuses, and so, you know, you have to give him kudos.
But the article implies that this is basically orchestrated to put the Tea Party stamp on the 2016 Republican election.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what King wants, and that's what a lot of the candidates that were there. I mean, it was an amazing list of candidates. Ted Cruz was there, Walker from Wisconsin, Sarah Palin, Donald Trump, Dr. Ben Carson, a lot of Tea Party favorites, Donald Trump, Newt Gingrich. I don't know if you know you consider him a Tea Party or not, but it was quite the roster, and certainly the Tea Party itself, the Tea Party Patriots, they were there. They were, you know, large. They were a very big presence. It was an event where the more conservative of the conservatives appealed to their base, and the 1,250 people that were there ate it up.
And what was conspicuously absent, of course, were some of the front runners, at least in terms of early polling: Jeb Bush, Mitt Romney, Marco Rubio, Bobby Jindal, and Rand Paul. So do you think their absence cost them?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think that that Steve King and Citizens United, I think that they wanted to get these 1,250 people talking about these as the only real Tea Party candidates out there. And that was, you know, that was an interesting ploy. It sort of, it leaves out by implication Jindal, Rubio, and Paul, but it was pretty explicit during the event. They were doing their best to, you know, let the axe fall on Jeb Bush and on Mitt Romney. It was clear they weren't, they don't want anything to do, especially Romney. They don't want anything to do with Romney again.
Well, Donald Trump was pretty blunt about that. Was he sounded like he was sort of somewhat, you know, still on his TV set saying you're fired, but he more or less said that these two, Bush, you know, and Romney, you know, been there, seen that, done that, forget about it, you know, that kind of brusque New York manner that he has.
Yeah, well, I'm an anthropologist, and in the Salon piece, I sort of evoked some Native American anthropology where there's the coyote trickster figure that sort of disobeys the rules and says things that other people don't want to say because they're too polite, they're clever, they trick people. It's a trickster character. And I sort of identified, well, I did identify Donald Trump as that coyote, and Sarah Palin as well. They say things nobody expects, nobody else would say. They're sometimes there's a certain truth to what they have to say. Sometimes there isn't, but they get away with all kinds of things. And I don't think anybody else at this stage of the career, of the campaign would have said, they would have been too polite to say, Scott Walker would have been too polite, Mike Huckabee would have been too polite to say, Romney struck out. He said the 47% comment isn't going away. Romney care isn't going away. He failed. We don't need Romney. The last thing we need is another Bush. Bush believes in Common Core. We don't. And so he just let the axe fall on them. And the Tea Partiers in the crowd, in the audience, just went wild.
So I read a transcript of some of Sarah Palin's remarks, though, and I found them completely incoherent.
They were just wacky. Absolutely, totally wacky. I didn't know it at the time, but they said her teleprompter failed. And she was, I don't know, she was just, yeah. It looks worse in print than when you heard it, because you know, you just thought she was just going off and saying all kinds of random things. But when you actually look at it, it's just, yeah, it was a disaster. But I knew it was just pure wackiness when I was seeing it. But I thought that was part of her act. I'd never seen Sarah Palin. I mean, I've seen her in crowds, and I couldn't get to her to interview her, but I've never. So I didn't really know what to expect. I see her on TV, but then, you know, mostly those are, you know, just choppy little bits. Or I saw her in her debate, you know, with Biden. But I didn't know what to expect except wackiness. But this was her at her worst, that's for sure.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Leonard, who's a special news editor for KNIA-KRLS Knoxville and Pella, Iowa, where he covered the 2008 and 2012 Iowa caucuses. He's an anthropologist and author of Yellow Cab and has an article at Salon.com, The World Has Gone to Hell, A Weekend at the Iowa Freedom Summit. Now, what's the World Has Gone to Hell reference to? Is that just that everybody in politics has to say that the sky is falling and if you elect me, sun will shine tomorrow and the future will look bright?
Well, there was some of that, but it was very explicit. It was like, Obamacare is a disaster. Obama is an embarrassment. Obama is a disaster. Everything he's touched has been terrible. We've got these, you know, incredible enemies, ISIS, us, you know, they want to behead us. We've got just, you know, the world is going to hell. There was a whole element of fear. You know, they were trying to get everybody to be fearful and afraid, and the Savior was on the stage in front of the audience, and they loved it. In general, I'm a pretty happy guy. I'm not fearful. Maybe they would probably call me naive. I think we're very lucky living in a great country, and I'm not very fearful. I am concerned with world events, certainly. Right.
But you don't have a jihadist problem in Iowa.
No, we don't. We don't have a terrorist problem, but. And so there, you know, maybe my naivete there, but it was just, there was this whole undercurrent of fear that was just sort of new to me. Maybe in New York they have that. Every day they walk around with that burden. I remember it from being a child during the Cold War, sort of having that fear. I don't know. So there was a whole fear component that either I just miss, or I actually think that they're stoking the flames of fear dare I say, hatred.
Well, of course, we know why Iowa is significant, because of the Iowa caucuses as the early bellwether for a presidential election. But it was usually chosen, or at least originally chosen, from my understanding, because it was a kind of state that was down the middle between Republicans and Democrats. And, of course, you know, the long-serving Senator Tom Harkin was extremely liberal. And yet the Iowans they elected Steve King some time back, but they've also just elected Tea Party Senator Joni Ernst, who recently gave the Republican response to the State of the Union. So has the state, that sort of bifurcation, ended? Is it has it moved to the right?
Well, maybe a little bit. Maybe not as much as we think. The election of Joni Ernst was a surprise. The Democratic heir apparent to Harkin was doing fine, was way ahead in the polls, and then he had a couple of gaffes, and then he just sort of blew it. And he, you know, I say in the article, he collapsed faster than Green Bay did in the playoffs with the Seattle Seahawks. And so I don't know if Iowa's turned as much to the right as it appears. If he wouldn't have run such an inept campaign, I think that we would have a Democrat there. But there are two Iowas, like there are two nations. I mean, Iowa City, Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, the big cities, they're blue. Much of rural Iowa is red and has always been red. And don't forget that we did bring the nation, for good or ill, whatever your perspective, Barack Obama. He won the Iowa caucuses on the Democratic side.
So in terms of this field, it's extraordinary. I mean, and it's growing. Just to quickly go through the list of speakers that you covered at the this last weekend's Freedom Summit, Robert Leonard in Iowa, Jim DeMint, Dr. Ben Carson, Donald Trump, Scott Walker, Newt Gingrich, Mike Lee, who says he's not running, Rick Santorum, Marsha Blackburn, John Bolton, Ted Cruz, Carly Farino, Sarah Palin, Rick Perry, Chris Christie, and Mike Huckabee, and then some lesser knowns, former Virginia Governor Jim Gilmore, Jeff Duncan, Congressman from South Carolina, and New Hampshire State Representative Bill O'Brien. And then, of course, some of the big names weren't there: Jeb Bush, Mitt Romney, Marco Rubio, Bobby Jindal, and Rand Paul. I don't know what the number is, but it's at least 20, right?
Oh, yeah. Can you believe that?
Well, there's chances that it'll actually grow, from my understanding. It's not going to be reduced. And is there anybody on the Republican side? You talk to any political operatives? Are they concerned about this extraordinary number of candidates?
Everybody I've talked to loves it. They especially love it because when you consider it in opposition to the Democrats, and I say in the salon piece, it's Hillary or Hillary or Hillary. And then, you know, then there's some talk of Elizabeth Warren, some talk of Joe Biden, but I mean, there's nothing like that. And I presume that, well, Elizabeth Warren has indicated she's not running, but I presume other people will emerge. We'll see. We'll see if the Iowa Democrats are ready to go for Hillary again. I don't know. I personally think it's nice to have a larger field. Well, it's still a little early, but you know, we'll see who comes out. But the Republicans have an incredible field. I've heard no party officials, I've heard nobody complaining about any of this.
Well, I was just thinking in terms of a presidential debate, if you have like 30 people on the stage, they'll each have about a minute or two to speak. And it's very difficult to get anything across, except, of course, our media is run by sound bites. Maybe he who has the best sound bite will be the nominee.
Well, that could happen. We'll see. I think it'll start winnowing out. I think that there's going to be some strategizing behind the scenes, especially with the establishment Republicans. I mean, one has to wonder what Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney talked about the other day when they met. And there's going to be some more of that. The Tea Party people, they're not going to pay a lot of attention to each other. There might be some deals. Personally, I think Sarah Palin's out. I don't think Donald Trump is important. They play an important role for the party in that coyote trickster kind of thing. But, you know, I think Ted Cruz is looking good. I think Scott Walker's looking good. I've seen Rubio on the ground in Iowa, and he looks good. He's not the guy we all saw sipping his drink uncomfortably in the response to the State of the Union address. Bobby Jindal, people like him here. All those people right now, they're rock stars. But the Tea Party, I mean, they go by their own rules. All those people are going by their own rules. So it could be they'll start following the polls, and there'll be polls soon. A friend of mine got a poll the other day asking her to rank 23 candidates. That's information's out there. If somebody continually in the polling falls down, they're not going to waste the money. What's going to happen is I suspect the money will start flowing two or three different directions, and the money will dictate. The money and the polling will dictate who emerges quickly, because nobody's going to be able to afford to. There aren't going to be 23 different campaigns because the money isn't out there for it.
Well, but the conventional wisdom has always been that on the Republican side, in the primaries, you got to hug the right and then move back to the center in the general, and the opposite is true with the Democrats. You got to hug the left in the primary and then go back to the center in the general. And if you're too far to the right on the Republican side or too far to the left on the Democratic side, you're not going to make it in the general. And so you don't see this Tea Party caucus manifested in this weekend's Iowa Freedom Summit having veto over who the candidate is?
I don't think so. I just think they're too independent. They're not going to move so much to the right and the left right now. I don't think what I do see is they're not talking about things that they would normally talk about. There was only one mention of gay marriage. We were there for over 9 hours. And one of the big issues 6 months ago, gay marriage, there was one time it was mentioned, was with the introduction of Chris Christie, when Steve King said, you'll be pleased to know that he vetoed, you know, something on the Defense of Marriage Act, you know, essentially making it impossible to get married in New Jersey. And he waited for the great applause, and like three people clapped. So only one person mentioned abortion, and that was Carly Fiorina. And so they're not talking about those issues that divide America. They don't want anything to do with gay marriage because they know it hurts most young people. So they're going to move, they're going to be to the right, they're moving to the center by not talking, even now, by not talking about those issues that divide America because they don't want it to be used against them later on.
So who, in your opinion, then, Robert Leonard, did the best on this last weekend's Iowa Freedom Summit?
I think Perry came out well. I think Ted Cruz is a force to be reckoned with. So is Scott Walker. Perry, we've seen him before. We know he emerged as a flawed candidate last time. So I think we'll recognize that he will again. It wouldn't surprise me if he made some more errors, although he was good.
But you say Ted Cruz was impressive.
He was slick. He's the, I called him, I think, the Bill Clinton of the
Republican
of the
world,
Republican Party,
right.
And he is smooth. He is slick, and I don't know if I haven't read the final version of the article, but the one I submitted, I said Democrats have slick Willie, the Republicans have slick Teddy, and it's not the philandering kind of Clinton, but it's the slick, the explainer in chief. He appeared statesmanlike. I think he's the real deal for the Tea Party people. And yeah, Scott Walker, he really surprised and impressed a lot of people too.
In the sense what, that he wasn't boring?
Well, yeah, he comes across on TV pretty darn boring. He comes across as besieged. He comes across as nobody likes him in Wisconsin. Yeah, I mean, and he seems like a flawed candidate because they've mounted a recall. But he wasn't the flawed, you know, sort of beleaguered person that I see on TV. He was dynamic. He had a list of conservative accomplishments the crowd really enjoyed hearing. It's like he's been tempered by fire. All those bad things that happened to him have made him more effective. And in person, which is what really matters in Iowa, because everybody gets to meet any candidate they want to, and they'll sit and listen to you and talk to you. It's in person. And that's another thing that we have to see. You know, Donald Trump isn't going to get his boots dirty talking to Iowans. We'll, you know, Hillary Clinton, is she going to get her boots dirty? I don't think so. What matters is you have to hit the coffee shops. It's pretty clear Hillary didn't like that. She didn't want anything to do with that. Obama does that. I think a lot of these Tea Party candidates, Rick Santorum does it. He does it all the time. I think we'll see if Bobby Jindal. We'll see how Marco Rubio does it. So a lot of it's going to be who has the patience to put up with, you know, all of us in our overalls and feed caps talking with us in barbershops talking with us in the store. That's going to be the key.
Well, just in closing then, Robert Leonard, tell me about the Dr. Ben Carson phenomenon, because he's been ahead in a lot of Republican straw polls for 2016 presidency. And, you know, it seems like a Republican effort to have their Barack Obama. But what's his credentials? Why is he popular, or is he popular?
He was the first speaker. And so he was more laid back. He didn't have anything to follow, and he was more laid back. He was very thoughtful. He was well received. He gave the only plan of he gave the only real solution to any problem that I ever saw in my 9 hours of watching. He said let's start a guest worker program for jobs Americans don't want. Seal the border, take applications for immigrants on the guest worker program from outside of our borders. Now, if you could actually seal the border, that makes some sense. He offers a solution. He just doesn't say seal the border, throw them all out.
Right.
So, I mean, that was very impressive. He's a smart guy. He's got an incredible life story. His mom had 22 children. Hmm. And it was 22 or 23, and he rose in poverty, but she was strong, made him work, and he rose up, and he says that since he could do it, anybody can do it. I mean, it sort of ignores the fact that just because he was exceptional doesn't mean that we're going to have a whole bunch of, not everybody from tough environments can be brain surgeons or neurosurgeons, and not everybody can exceed, and it doesn't deny that there's institutional barriers in place, and racism still exists. But I don't think that we can act like it doesn't, despite his great success.
Well, Robert Leonard, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you, Ian. I'm honored.
Oh, well, I'm grateful for your time. And again, I'm speaking with Robert Leonard, a special news editor at KNI KRLS, Knoxville and Pella, Iowa, where he covered the 2008 and 2012 Iowa caucuses. He's an anthropologist and author of Yellow Cab and has an article at Salon.com, The World Has Gone to Hell, A Weekend at the Iowa Freedom Summit. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.